This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
I'm Chris Holmes, and this is Burned by Books. Here you'll find interviews with writers you already love, like Jennifer Egan and Rebecca Mackay, mixed in with up-and-coming voices like Alexandra Kleeman and Rahman Alam. You'll find us wherever you listen to podcasts, but check out previous episodes at burnedbybooks.com and on Instagram and Twitter at burnedbybooks. Let's start the show. In Mina Seçkin's debut novel, The Four Humors, Sybil, a Turkish student preparing for med school in the United States, and her American boyfriend, Cooper, are in Istanbul for a summer to help care for Sybil's grandmother. It is a placeholder in their lives, which otherwise rush forward with plans and dreams of a future in a different place. The return to Erdogan's Turkey, a place of uncomfortable tensions and the dramatic tightening of government control over political and human rights, sets the scene for Sybil's quest to understand her evolving relationship to her home country, to her family, to her loved ones, and to her body itself. As Sybil introduces Cooper to Turkey, she finds herself ironically abstracted from the places and people that she once called home. Sybil's quest to understand her feelings of distance and to recenter her notion of family takes a dramatic form in the theory of the bodily humors, the classic understanding of how the fluids and organ functions of our bodies are often at war with one another, and that finding balance is necessary for health and well-being. As Sybil visits cultural and historical sites and recounts a history full of both civilization and barbarity, she imagines the ways in which her body and the lineage of bodies before her have failed to find that balance. Sybil's own struggles and her persistent guilt about the death of her father rest atop an explosive family secret. It is a secret that will challenge the nature of Sybil's bloodline and the connective tissues that link her to a place and to a sense of home and family. Told with a humor and wisdom, with a heart full of blood, bile, and choler, Four Humors refuses expectations for what an immigrant's journey will look like, sound like, and feel like. Mina Seçkin has made a place for herself in the rich tradition of contemporary literatures that take up the past as both the grand narratives of political history and the local familial stories that give flesh and body to that history. Mina Seçkin completed her MFA at Columbia University, where she received the Felipe de Alba Fellowship and where she also received her bachelor's degree. Her work has been published in Refinery 29, McSweeney's Quarterly Concern, Electric Literature, The Rumpus, and elsewhere. She serves as a managing editor of Apogee Journal. Welcome, Mina.
Hi, Chris. Thank you so much for that introduction. That was wonderful. I'm so excited to be here.
Thank you so much for being here. I'm looking at the cover of this novel, which has to be one of the most sort of beautiful and stark and just extraordinary images on a cover that I've seen in many years. It's a half of a face with a blooming of flowers coming out of the top of it. And I wonder if you tell me the story of how that came into being.
Yeah. So this cover, the artwork on this cover, is actually a piece by this Turkish artist, Ekin Sukoç, who works in, she lives in Germany, and a lot of her work has to do with collage and finding sort of primary sources of women throughout the years in different spaces and putting those together in a way that is often cut up and distorted. I have loved her work for a very long time, and I had told Catapult about her work, and they reached out to her and went with one of her pieces. And when I actually first spoke to Ekin Sukoc, we were amazed at how our work, my written work and her visual artwork, seems to be using the same tools to tell the same story of, like you expressed so wonderfully, say, the lineage of bodies before a woman, and how the map and the spaces around her both disrupt that body and allow it to potentially be free. Yeah.
I don't think I've ever heard an author describe such a synergy between an artist of a cover work and their own work. I think that's really amazing.
Yeah, it really feels like a translation along genre or an adaptation, right? The way so many people complain about a movie not being adapted properly. I actually feel like her artwork it feels like an adaptation, and vice versa. Yeah.
Oh, wonderful. I hope she feels similarly pleased with that connection.
Yeah, right.
The four humors of the title, blood, phlegm, bile, and choler, become a possible Rosetta Stone for Sybil as she attempts to understand her relationship to her body, her family, her language and culture, and to try and come to a balance between those elements of her life which feel out of sorts. What drew you to this ancient classical philosophy of the bodily humors, and why was it a meaningful way for you to have Sybil consider what is imbalanced in her life?
Yeah, the four humors are quite a Rosetta Stone for her. I had first been drawn to the humors. I actually had read this tiny little blurb in the journal Latham's Quarterly about St. Margaret Mary Alacoque, who was a nun in the 1600s. She had started receiving these visions from Christ, but nobody believed her naturally, and they decided she was delusional and too full of passion. so they once a month they bloodlet her in this stone basin.
Gosh, this is what you describe in the book. It's so terrible.
Yeah, and to cure her. and I mean, that's ridiculous, right? But that was the medical, those were genuinely the medical guidelines of the time, perhaps, right? And I immediately became obsessed with the four humors, and I needed to learn everything about them. Especially because I was so interested in, say, how much the moral prescriptions that medicine put on human beings back then, and even today, say, what constituted health and who had the resources to seek it. And there's a lot in there that, say, you find out a lot about the societal values going on at that time based on how they are treating people or what needs treatment, right? And in terms of, say, women's health and reproductive health, it was just as thorny then as it continues to be today, say.
I'm thinking of I think this only changed recently, but I believe there were a number of conditions that that prevented a woman from getting pregnant that were referred to as inhospitable uterus.
Yes, yeah.
And there's so much of that, like, sprinkled throughout medicine today. So it's it seems like we haven't learned much.
No, we definitely have not learned much. And yeah, the inhospitable womb and the history of, say, hysteria is definitely one that is rooted in, actually, like, comes very much so from the four humors, I understanding, that your uterus being sick is why you are emotionally not stable. Yeah. And so that really resonated with me as something that a person, especially a woman, deals with. And at the same time, in my own life, when I was writing this book, I was staying with my grandma and my great grandma in Istanbul. And I was there working at a political journal for that summer. And my grandma had just been diagnosed with Parkinson's, and my great grandma had Alzheimer's and dementia. She was near 100. But though we don't really know how old she was, and every night, like every few nights, it was a really difficult time, because every few nights she would pee the bed, and my grandmother and I would clean her and change the sheets. It really, really impacted me the way my grandma, even though she was sick too, continued to take care of her mother. It really, the way that familial care continued to reinforce itself again and again, the way female caretakers continue to do that work, never really commended for it, too, sort of continuing to do it in quiet and behind closed doors, made me feel like, I don't know, I wanted to shed light on that exact thing.
Yeah, it's a tacit understanding that caretaking will be done largely by women and without comment.
Yeah. Rubs against like the history of medicine in a very interesting way. The history of medicine is not, say, known to be a field where there are a lot of women.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Down in history. Yeah.
So for me, it's Sybil's narrative voice that makes this such a fabulous and riveting novel. Mm-hmm. That first person voice and tone operates with a great deal of distance from the events of Sybil's life, as though it were watching from a reserve. Mm-hmm. This mirrors Sybil's own sense of questioning and even alienation. Was Sybil's voice and perspective there for you from the start? And did you draw on any particular examples of voice in work that you admire?
Mm. Yeah, her voice was there from the start. There was so much that influenced it. Say, I know I spent a lot of my earliest sort of coming of age as a writer reading a different mixture of books, where I loved say Rachel Cusk and Miriam Toews and Marguerite Duras and Sheila Hedy, this sort of dislocated female narrator trying to make sense of the world. At the same time, I also really was drawn to say a narrator that is a bit, say, a newer kid on the block, maybe kids of immigrant narrators who are a little more like female narrators who are a little more blasphemous and unruly, say Jade Sharma or Jenny Zhang. And I wanted the two of them to collide in a way.
Oh yeah, I feel the like Hedy and Cusk and the Jenny Zhang here very much.
Yeah. And that is a voice is always where does a writer's voice come from, and can it be changeable? I always think about that, and I feel like voice is something that can be manufactured and changed based on a character, right? But there's always going to be an essential element of the way you see the world and what you see in the world, but more importantly, what you consider to be music in language, I think is what will always define whatever voice as a writer you ultimately need to speak in for the story that you're telling. And in this story, I feel like this narrator's voice had to continue to sort of both dislocate and look for emotion wherever it could. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Sybil's intellect is seemingly in constant tension with the way her body reacts to the world. In this way, her body becomes its own form of narration. That disjunct between body and mind exists for all of us, and it's something that we constantly as humans have to reckon with, the story that happens inside of us and the story that happens external to us. But how did you work on making them competing narratives in Sybil's life?
That's really interesting. Yeah, I feel like it makes me think of just thinking about, say, first person versus third person, right? On a craft level, I always think about how when you're in the first person, there's a big challenge to say, show the narrator from the outside. And show their body from the outside, right?
Yeah.
And in this book, it was really, really fascinating to play with. I had to use the women around Sybil to show what she, say, looked like, right? She had such a bodily presence that may or may not match what's going on in her head, which is an entire world of a world that she can't shut off. And I wanted to say there were so many different ways to do that on a craft level, using those other women, but also using her sister Alara, who is rapidly losing weight and has an eating disorder and is holding the grief and every intergenerational thing in her body in such a different way than Sybil is, who is also not only feels sick, but is also essentially binge eating all summer, right? It's so fascinating. There was such a cool way of looking at all these different women and how they were looking at one another and defining themselves against each other.
Makes so much sense. The body exhibiting the means with which grief is working itself through. Sybil's father dies from a heart attack while making tea in the kitchen. And this is an enormous burden of guilt and loss. And this burden both draws Sybil back to Turkey and keeps her from properly mourning his complicated death. Her father, in many ways, stands in for her relationship to her broader family and even to her country. The second half of the novel will delve into family secrets and her father's history. Can you speak to the ways that complicated family histories and complicated national histories intertwine in the novel?
I love this question, and I think it is so, say, essential to an understanding of Turkish history, which I believe is Turkish history is very fraught. As we were talking about in the beginning, just for example, when the Turkish Republic was established, they changed the language from Ottoman Arabic to the Romanized alphabet, essentially stripping people of their ability to read, right?
Which is such a jaw-dropping historical story.
Yeah, right. And yeah, Turkish history is full of just buried information that the state has buried, denied Armenian genocide, continued, say, violence against the Kurds. There's so much that cannot be discussed in Turkish history, and that people and my own family grew up going to school not learning the correct stuff, right? And I think that is not without its, that breeds a lot of sort of horror in a family that then gets passed down. And I really wanted, say, Sybil's father and what she feels about her father and the family secret that comes out is so rooted in a structure of a family that has to exist within a nation that has to follow certain rules, where citizens have to follow certain rules, right? And so when she finds out that structure of the family is not what it actually seemed, and the intense measures that were taken to, say, correct the family, right? To, say, not make one of the women queer in that time period when she was, right? To make sure that the baby was I guess I won't go into all that, but anyway, anyway, there's a lot that is not that say this nation state is not allowing to happen that Cybele confronts, right? Mm-hmm. And in terms of say, I really thought about this in terms of the form and structure of the novel too, where just as the family structure turns out to be quote unquote broken, I wanted the form of the novel to be too, right? To have the past bubble up and like almost as if it is throw up or bile, right? To bubble up and break the present.
So I think a question I have picks up on that, and that's that for Cybele, some of the things that are unsettling her humors are the ghosts of generational trauma, of national mm-hmm. trauma, that she feels in a kind of deep well of history in her bodily memory. Yeah. Cybele hears stories of torture and murder and violence and anger and abandonment. Mm-hmm. And one of the sites of the traumas are the protests in Gezi Park?
Gezi
Park, that were crushed by the government. Thousands were injured, protesting a variety of things, but the loss of certain secular rights being principal among them. Can you talk about how Cybele experiences generational trauma and how you think literature might contribute to addressing that trauma?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think she experiences it in a particularly, say, insider, outsider way, because she's not just Turkish, she's American. And so she gets to see her family's Turkish trauma from a different perspective, right? She gets to, when you are from the outside looking at something, you don't see it correctly, right? You see it with a gaze, especially a Western gaze, which can be harmful, but she has access to the exact trauma as well because it is her family and because she is still Turkish. And I think her generational trauma is one that by spending in Turkey, she has to confront. It's almost a second coming of age in that way. I think in general with generational trauma, one confronts it constantly and one buries it constantly.
Interesting.
Yeah, and one is forced to reckon with it constantly or rarely, right? And I think in the novel, I think all novels are inherently political and all novels inherently deal with this kind of trauma and weight of the past. I always think about Orhan Pamuk's novel Snow and the history of kind of a lot of novels that deal with, say, an identity like a Turkish identity, right? Where you can't just say that the Armenian genocide happened in the book. You have to sort of put it in a coded manner, right? Mm-hmm. Or in Orhan Pamuk's Snow, he doesn't, you know, he doesn't use those words in the book. He, of course not. He can't, but also that would then be propaganda that might make the art a different thing, right? But he constantly in that book mentions the homes that Armenians built that are now standing like mausoleums, right?
Yeah.
And I honestly think that so many novels are those exact, say, city structures that are standing like mausoleums. I wanted my narrator.
Now you sound like Faulkner.
Yeah, that's so true. but yeah, I really do believe that, yeah, since the novel is a inherently political piece of art, the things within it are holding more than the living, right? And I wanted this narrator too. She moves through Istanbul, aware of that weight and the weight of the many taboos that have oppressed people who have lived in Istanbul over all the generations. And she has both an access and a freedom, and is confined to that same curse of carrying it.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Lest I make the audience think that this is an unbearably serious book, which, you know, it certainly is serious and thoughtful, but it is also full of wit and humor, mm-hmm. often in really surprising moments. And one of my favorite of those scenes is when Cooper and Cybele go to the bodies exhibit, which take real human bodies and display them preserved, but in lifelike action. And I wonder if you'd read a bit from that section.
Yes, I would love to. Yes, that is a funny section. There is humor in the book. In the exhibit, the text on the walls introducing the gallery apologized for itself. "We know this may be strange," the curators wrote on a white wall, "but you can learn a lot from the mysteries of the body." For some reason, they used a glittering pink color for the text. I translate the more obscure Turkish for Cooper. In the first room, more than 50 skulls are tacked to the wall. It is not clear who these skulls belong to, but most died from smoking, or, the four humors would say, black bile. I explain to Cooper that black bile makes a person brood, gloom, and withdraw, but black bile also has the power to thicken blood, allowing it to clot. Those with an excess of black bile can repair their bodies with impressive speed and minimal scar tissue. Mozart was diagnosed with rheumatic fever, which was thought to be caused by excess black bile in his brain. Academics passionately debate whether this scandalous rumor is true, that Mozart really died from an infection caused by the bloodletting procedure meant to cure him. George Washington, too, woke up one morning with a sore throat, and after his doctor drained numerous pints of his blood in one day, died. Then we see the bodies themselves, preserved in a process called plastination, where scientists replace bodily fluids and fat with liquid plastic, later hardened, molded, and posed into lifelike forms. Some of the bodies are so well preserved in orange tendons and skin, I find myself suddenly looking at a sculpture. "Don't you think," I say to Cooper, "that these seem so real that they're like sculptures?" He looks into a pair of glass eyes. "But sculptures are the unreal," he says. This is the real thing." Cooper begins to debate what is real and not real, pointing at body parts, limbs, lips, vulvas. The necks have so many dried vessels and tendons, a web of orange and white strands like fresh prosciutto. Cooper said this, the fresh prosciutto thing. He has not eaten pig all summer, so he's confusing what is dried and what is fresh. I also miss eating pigs. Mortadella is my favorite pork product after hot dogs. Prosciutto is dry cured after all, Cooper points out, rubbed with salt, then preserved. This is about what we can learn, I say. This is not about prosciutto. I'm just saying these guys are preserved with plastic, not salt. Doesn't plastic seem unnatural? This is about medicine, I say. It's about how doctors learned what to do to make us live longer lives. Look, I say, here's a man who died of excessive alcohol consumption. Here's a man whose knee replacement got infected. Here is a smoker. I shut up. The late smoker looks back at me with a stern, dried up face.
Thank you. That was really wonderful to hear. And it was hard to keep myself from laughing. The prosciutto part, just, I don't know, it tickles me every time. Yeah. It's this both this sense of the viscerality of everything that they're looking at. Bodies sort of inside out, bodies preserved, but also supposed to, you know, bare lifelike appearance. And prosciutto is this preserved meat of this pig. And the fact that you've brought them together here in this exhibit and they're arguing about what counts as real and what doesn't is really funny. It's also grim, and it's very much macabre in a way that those skulls are memento moris for the people coming to the exhibit, but very specifically for Cybele, who's trying to give up smoking, or is told anyway that she should give up smoking. So why is the macabre a good sight for humor for you? And what was it like to kind of draw out the humor from this scene?
Yeah, that's so interesting. It is quite macabre. And I think anytime I make a lot of jokes, I guess, in my everyday life, and I need to laugh a lot, and I often find most things absurd, right? And the fact of the matter is that such an exhibit horrifies me and genuinely scares me, right? And so I need them to walk through it and see the absurdity of it, right? And even the absurdity of, say, putting sort of human beings in a museum like this is, yeah, it is pretty funny, and it is educational.
I remember when this, I think it's the same exhibit, they're like, yeah. Bodies Alive or something, came to Philadelphia, and I went to it, and I really was repulsed by it.
Yeah, no, it is repulsive. It's repulsive. And yeah, there's something about, in general, I feel like I always write about the body with a lot of, I'm very interested in the body, but I am genuinely horrified by, say, an incision to the body, you know, like what is underneath the body both fascinates me and terrifies me. I am afraid of that. Yeah. And I think that definitely is incorporated in this character, say, desire to both be a doctor and not want to do it for so many different reasons. Yeah. I didn't go to the fascination exhibit where
you're best to skip it.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. I went to the Muter Museum in Philadelphia, and that's where this was inspired from. And then I learned about plastination. Yeah. And the Muter Museum, my sister and my brother are both doctors, and I am the black sheep writer. And I went with the three of them.
You must be such a disappointment.
Yeah, right? Oh, yeah. and I went with the three of them, and they were just nerding out about all these sort of, I think the museum is a museum of death. I forget what the exact translation is, but it's something like that.
Yeah.
Very macabre place. And they were just obsessed with the museum. They were like little school children being like, oh my God, look at this, look at this, look at this. And I was just in a corner, like staring at the skulls, writing in my notes app. And then I left early because I was disturbed.
Well, I mean, you clearly chose the right career based on your reaction to it.
Yeah, the skulls inspired me.
So Sybil's boyfriend Cooper is such an interesting character, and Sybil is both intrigued and somewhat dismayed at the ease with which he finds connection, or seems to find connection, with her family and friends. Mm-hmm. At times, he seems closer to her grandmother than she is, despite knowing only limited Turkish. Can you talk about the ways in which the Four Humors complicates the notion of feeling at home in one's country and playing with the nuanced ways in which we are connected to a place while feeling distant from it, and how Cooper sort of really kind of sets that alight in Sybil?
Yeah. I feel like, I mean, most of that feeling, that complicated feeling, is just one that I simply have lived with and carried my whole life, right? The feeling of feeling alien in some regard in America, and going to your motherland and thinking you're going to suddenly feel so at home, but you're othered there too. You don't speak it properly. You don't have as many memories there, but your whole family is there. You look around and suddenly, for the first time, every single person looks just like you. So those feelings came from a place within me. With Cooper, Cooper is one of those perfect, craft-wise, he's this perfect lens, or forces the exact lens that I wanted for Sybil. In that I always think about, say, who I'm writing for and the gaze, right? I didn't want this book to be a book that explained Turkishness in a way that would further other it, right? I didn't want to explain why certain things were happening that related to, say, Turkish culture. Having Cooper there, first of all, Sibel being American and experienced and being able to say, and being interested in analyzing the differences between Turkishness and Americanness was a good way to say, not cater to that gaze, but explain the things that I found funny about the in-betweenness, right? And Cooper further was an interesting way to talk about the exact Western gaze and kind of the complicated line between fetishizing and exotifying a place and genuinely loving it, right? Mm-hmm. And so he almost, in a way where I hope did not say he wasn't just a gaze or a perspective, he almost like he effectively made that happen so well, I think.
He does that really well. And he's his own character as well. He feels fully fleshed, but he certainly offers us that that different kind of vision of a place.
Yeah.
I'm very interested in the role that Turkish soap operas play, in part because this is the second novel I've read in recent weeks that has Turkish soap operas playing an interesting cultural background role. Have you read Nazlı Koca's The Applicant?
Yes, I love Nazlı's book so much.
It's a really wonderful book. And I found your books are very different, but I loved that the Turkish soap opera operates as a kind of counter narrative to what's going on in contemporary Turkey.
Yeah.
And it is a romanticized a vision of history and the present. And I wondered why you wanted it there and what it's doing for you in the novel.
Mm-hmm. Oh my God. Yeah. I can talk endlessly about Turkish soap operas.
I figured you could based on the way they're described.
They're absolutely booming in Turkey, the Middle East and South America, I believe.
Oh, fascinating.
Yeah. And I mean, I've always thought, talk about absurdity. It's insane how much the stories in soap operas do not in any way at all excavate the actual drama in Turkish history, right? and they don't actually say, they're so far behind catching up to any drama. And instead, they use the same tired tropes. They're not telling the truth, which makes me really angry, actually, right? And I actually think about it in terms of, say, what is kind of expected, again, talking about, say, the traditional family structure is something that is really at this novel's core. And I wanted the traditional family structure to almost mimic, say, what a soap opera is supposed to be, right? But what happens when the soap opera is sort of like punctured and actually the truth comes out of the soap opera? Yeah, it's so funny. These soap operas, and like I've watched a lot of them always with my mom and my grandma, and the things they say, and they'll kind of complain about them too, being like, oh, they'd never do this, they'd never show this, but they don't talk about those things either in their own lives. So it's funny, everyone's just using this commonly accepted form of entertainment to hide a lot of things.
I love that description of it. And I think that's the same with American soap operas.
Oh, yeah. I wasn't very versed in, say, like The Bachelor. I only started watching it a little recently with like a group of friends. I watched like maybe one or two seasons. Blows my mind. It's not even entertainment. It's literally propaganda to continue to reemphasize social norms that have been outdated for decades, but yeah,
if they existed at all.
It's like it, and it's so forceful, and it's not even real, right? Like you learn about this is more reality TV, but still you learn about what's going on behind the scenes, and it's not even real.
They are an incredible sounding board for thinking about what the culture wants to hide, though. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what they do so well in The Four Humors.
Yeah, there's barely a single, I don't think, I could be wrong, but I haven't heard of a single, say, queer character in Turkish soap operas or
television. Oh my goodness. Wow.
Yeah.
Well, that says a lot right there.
Yeah. And there's say, like, they love their they love a Romeo and Juliet story, a story about, say, like, different people from different classes falling in love and the family's not allowing it. Yeah, that's it.
Well, yeah. I'm going to have to watch them just so, because I've now read two novels that are have real connections to them. So I think I'm going to have to do some viewing.
Yeah.
Before I let you go, I'd love to learn a little bit about what you're reading and loving right now, and if you have any recommendations for our listeners.
Yes, definitely. And I just read this book called The House of Doors, which is coming out this week, I believe, by Tan Tuan Eng. And it's set in 1920s colonial Malaysia. And it is so fascinating. And it actually has to do with a lot of what we've just been talking about what society allows and what society does not allow, about sort of immense sexual repression and the even legal consequences of, say, an affair. It's so, 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 so good. And yeah, it was the kind of book that I started at, say, like 5 p.m. and I didn't put it down until like 12 a.m.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Wow.
And I read into the night. It just is very transporting. Yeah, it was really, really quite good.
Great recommendation.
Yeah, yeah. I think it came out this week. And then I've also just started Carnality by Lena Wolf, which I really love.
Is that the Swedish writer?
Yeah. Yeah. So good. It's very surprising, and it constantly, and it's very darkly funny and very, very, very absurd. And I love any book, whenever a narrative voice is, say, absurd, I love it so much, because it just like lightly touches on these things that are so horrifying, and it continues blazing on. And it makes you really question, the voice itself makes you question sort of good and bad in morality. It's really good.
A book titled Bret Easton Ellis something. And Other Dogs. Easton Ellis and Other Dogs, which is so great and similar in the way you're describing that sort of ironic, sarcastic voice.
She's so good. She's so good. Yeah. Very funny too.
Mm-hmm.
Makes you sort of like look up and see things differently. And then I'm also reading, I just finished rereading again, Aria Aber's collection of poetry, Hard Damage, which I really love. I think it's such a beautiful collection. It is really about, say, displacement and being a refugee and an immigrant, or the things that intergenerational trauma and a very real trauma that continues in everyday life, and who is sort of complicit in that. Yeah, it's a really good, really great collection.
I'm very happy to have some poetry recommended as well. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I want to recommend to my audience that they pick up The Four Humors. I really loved the book. I feel like it has so much to say to not just the immigrant experience, but to our experience of the dissonance we have between our family histories, our national histories, and the way we feel about ourselves. And I hope that lots of people will read it. And it's been such a pleasure getting to talk to you about it, Mina.
It's been so lovely talking to you too. Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for your time.
Well, that's all from me for now. My thanks to Mina Sechkin for a wonderful conversation about her novel, The Four Humors, available now from Catapult Books. You can find links to purchase The Four Humors and all of Mina's recommended books at the website, burntbybooks.com. There you'll find all of our previous episodes, links to buy a podcast t-shirt, and ways to get in contact. As you listen, take a moment to rate the show on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen. Until next time, this has been Burned by Books.